Okay, and tonight our first speaker is going to be Rich.
Good evening, everyone. I'm a recovered alcoholic named Rich Paul. And I get to say the word recovered today because that was what was taught to me by my sponsor in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. What it really means is I just had an opportunity to get well. I had an opportunity to get well from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And that was something that I never thought was possible. I appreciate you all having me down here tonight. My sobriety date is June 24th, 2011. And the Central Orlando group is my home group. I'm going to try to get through in a brief way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. It was a steel town up north on May 31st, 1988. So for any of y'all who like math, that makes me 24 today. Well, not today, but you know what I mean. I was the first of two sons to two loving parents, born into a great family. I had no real complaints growing up from the exterior. I don't come from a background of abuse or any issues. I don't have any cousins, aunts, uncles, parents, grandparents that were alcoholics. So, you know, that's just not part of my story. That was never on my radar. But I did feel very different growing up. I always kind of didn't feel a part of. If I saw someone else talking on the other side of the room, you were definitely talking about me. And if you were talking about me, it definitely wasn't good. And so I was afraid a lot. You know, I was more worried about what you thought about me than what I thought about myself. And, you know, that's the long and short of my childhood growing up. It was just that feeling different, that feeling of never feeling a part of, regardless of what the situation was. And what I came to find through that was, you know, I saw some friends in their early teens get busted for drinking on a school trip. And I thought I was smarter than them, so I would just only drink on vacations because it was easier accessible then. I could control it, you know, all those special things that we tell ourselves. The other part was I always knew where I wanted to go to college, so I just kind of put off my drinking until then. You know, I would have it on the vacations and, you know, just hold on until college. But when I got to college, things came on with a vengeance very quickly. I started college with the idea that, okay, Friday and Saturday nights are going to be party nights. But, you know, then very quickly a bunch of the guys wanted to invite me out for Monday night football. So what goes better with Monday night football than beer and pizza? So Monday night became a drinking night. And, you know, nothing really important happens in school on Fridays. I mean, professors practically already know we're just aching for the weekend anyway. There are no exams, no quizzes, so Friday classes really aren't that important. So very quickly, Thursday became a drinking night. And there's more football on Sunday, so once again, got to have drinks to go with that. So within a few months, I went from someone who was just going to drink two nights a week to someone who was easily drinking five nights a week. And it wasn't that hard to find an excuse or somebody to drink with on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. I didn't necessarily drink every day consistently, but then again, there were also weeks at a time where I would, you know, lay in bed at night wondering, when's the last time I went to bed and had not had a drink in my system and couldn't remember? You know, growing up, I had watched my dad get together with his fraternity brothers, you know, for the big game, go on ski trips together, be there for each other when things got hard. And, you know, being someone who never felt a part of, I wanted that. I thought to myself, if I joined a fraternity, well, then that'll solve all my problems. I'll have a group of guys who will always have my back. Looking back on it, the reason, you know, my dad and his buddies always had each other's back is because they were always there for him in the first place. You know, they were always there for each other, whereas I just kind of came into it with an entitled sense of view. You know, I started college with the idea that, you know, alcohol was synonymous with, you know, good-looking women, parties, drinking games, and I know no one in this room can relate to being competitive at all. But I was very competitive, and, you know, that's how I started to build self-worth, was through winning drinking games. You know, I would say to myself, well, if I keep winning, people will want to be on my team. You know, I would feel a part of. People would be excited to see me. You know, people, you know, if they keep losing to me, they're going to want to keep coming back and challenging me. And that's a pretty skewed perception of reality. You know, I was that guy who always was trying to egg his buddies on until, you know, okay, no, the girlfriend can wait. You can drink some more. You know, stay up a little later. Push it a little harder. And, you know, the only time that was bedtime for me was usually if I saw the sun coming up or if I was passed out somewhere by that point. I did end up joining a fraternity because I thought that that would solve my issues, but clearly not. You know, my world got a lot smaller. Because I didn't visit friends at other schools. I said, just come here, I have a better party school. And then I didn't even visit other friends and different parties on campus. I was like, well, I could walk all the way there to drink, or I could drink in my own house. So the laziness factor jumped in pretty quick there. You know, it started out fun, but it rapidly progressed to the point where, you know, I didn't want to have people hanging out with me. You know, the girlfriend was gone. The grades were dropping. I don't have to tell y'all really what it's like to drink. Y'all probably wouldn't be here if you didn't already know for yourself. I did manage to squeak through college, sometimes by just kind of pulling it off at the last minute, sometimes by manipulating and cheating my way through. But at that point, you know, I thought, well, if I just move to Florida, everything will be better. So I tried that geographic cure to a warmer climate. Unfortunately, that didn't work either. You know, I went through some jobs, and, you know, one I left because I didn't like how I was being treated. Another I left because my drinking caught up with me. I just didn't see it yet. And, you know, what I found from that was that I really, as I said before, I didn't have a good perception of reality. You know, if it was a good day, I would drink. If it was a bad day, I would drink. If it was an indifferent day, I would drink. If it was a holiday, I would drink. You know, if there was a home game, I would drink. If there was an away game, I would drink. If it was off season, we just had a super Saturday and drank anyway. You know, we took any excuse we could. And I hung out with people who, you know, drank similar but not necessarily the same way I did. You see, I was used to on a Sunday pretty much piecing together my weekend with the guys of, you know, the various parts of the blackout that weekend. So we would, you know, that way it kind of usually helped me figure out where to find my cell phone, where to find my wallet, where to find my ID, where to find my jacket. And when you live up in Pennsylvania and it's wintertime, it's a pretty big deal when you're missing your jacket. So, you know, I thought this Florida cure would work, but it obviously didn't. You know, and each time I got into trouble, I would never want to admit it was my drinking. And by that point, you know, I'd tried getting healthy and, you know, losing some of the beer weight as a reason to stop drinking, and that lasted a few weeks. I tried only drinking beer because who gets drunk on just beer? This guy. You know, I tried only drinking with certain groups of friends. That didn't last long. You know, this, that, the other. I tried controlling it or just having a few. That never happened. Or playing just one drinking game. That never happened. But I was never willing to admit that the alcohol was the issue. You know, oh, I just need to do this to blow off steam because, you know, you'd need to blow off steam too if you dated the girl I did. You know, those were the types of things I said to myself. The insanity really came to a head when I was, you know, after I'd gotten fired from that job. I was traveling around the country, kind of picking up work here and there and visiting some of the guys and visiting some of my fraternity brothers. And, you know, one night it was one of those nights where I just kind of threw caution to the wind, which was normal. And I don't remember much of that night, but from what I'm told, my buddy who looks like a lumberjack, my buddy who is a mixed martial artist, and my buddy who's a football player all had to hold me down that night because I was out of control and they were worried I was going to leave the place and hurt myself or hurt somebody else. And even though the three of them were holding me down, I was still able to kick down a door and a door frame. And I don't say that because I'm proud of it. I say it because that's the level of insanity my disease had taken me to. You know, the next day I was ready to just, you know, write it off, you know, laugh it off. You co-sign my BS, I co-sign yours. You know, do a standard round of apologies the next day and it would all be okay. And I was this close to writing it off. Fortunately, I'm not very handy with fixing doors or door frames. So I had to call my uncle to come help me out. And after he fixed the door with one of his employees, you know, I said, well, you know, I really appreciate this. How can I compensate you? You know, how can I repay you? And he looked straight at me and he said, never pick up a drink again. I don't think you can do it, but never pick up a drink again. Within 3 to 5 years, you're going to be in debt. You're going to be dead or in jail. And I knew he was absolutely right the way I was spiraling. He told me how he dated an alcoholic for a long time, and he tried to support her in getting sober, but she didn't want it. And she couldn't stay sober, so he couldn't stay. And that hit home, so I went for a place to stay that evening, and, you know, for some reason the next morning, you know, all cut up, banged up, bruised up, a shine of the nicest color of purple I think I'd ever seen. You know, something said go to an AA meeting, and I got there a little late at the bottom of this Baptist church up in Delaware, and there was half a dozen little old ladies with white hair and one toothless old man. So I had a little bit of trouble identifying at that first meeting. But I was in enough pain that I decided to, you know, go check out another one that evening. I really couldn't figure out at first how they knew I was new at that meeting that night. Looking back on it, I think it was probably pretty obvious when a guy's coming into the room with a shiner. He's trying to hide his face with his hat, and you know, you can still smell the alcohol seeping from his pores from the night before. You know, I thought I was so good at covering that up, all that delusion that I put myself through. I don't remember much of that meeting, but I remember them asking if someone had a desire not to drink anymore, and I got up and I got a chip. And I remember afterwards I was given this book sitting in front of me. I'd never met any of those people. And, you know, barely any of my friends wanted to have anything to do with me. So it really made an impact on me that these people I'd never met before were so excited to see me and wanted to give me a book for free. It made an impact. I've also come to learn that the book doesn't do much good if you just put it in the bottom of your suitcase or a backpack and carry it around for a month and a half, that you actually have to open it up. And, you know, I've come to find that the only thing scarier than a drunk is a dry drunk. Because alcohol wasn't the issue at the end of the day. Alcohol was my coping mechanism, and once I put down my coping mechanism, I actually get crazier if I don't pick up a new coping mechanism. So until I really got serious about getting sober, about getting a sponsor, about getting into the book and getting into the steps, I was a real danger to myself and anyone around. And, you know, what it finally took for me to really hit that place where I was willing to really do something about it was my younger brother is pretty much my favorite person in the entire world. And, you know, one day I was in the car with him and some of his buddies, and he told me I was a mean, violent drunk. And, you know, I couldn't understand why he was being so mean to me. I couldn't understand why he was being so mean to me, why he would say something like that. He told me, I love you because you're my brother, but if we met on the street, we wouldn't be friends. Here's my favorite person in the world, and this is what he's saying to me. And that took me to a place where I wasn't sure if I wanted to live or die at this point. Quite frankly, I didn't want to die, but I didn't know any other way to break the cycle. You know, I thought the only thing left that I could do to be helpful to my family at this point was find a way to kill myself so I could have them collect the insurance money. Fortunately, after a few desperation prayers, I decided that maybe I should get back to Orlando, where my home is, and try this AA thing. And that's what I did. I got back there real quick and went to a meeting and asked the chairperson afterwards, what's this whole sponsor thing about? And she very calmly pointed me to the gentleman outside, and I had the foolish idea of saying, well, you know, I need to have a sponsor who's like this, and I need to have a sponsor who has this experience, and, you know, this similarity to me, and this same background. And a guy just kind of looked at me and goes, dude, you're not going to marry him. Just pick a sponsor, start working the steps. If it doesn't work out, get a new one. That's how it works around here. And I went out to coffee with these guys. You know, I'd lived in Orlando, you know, almost a year and never made a friend. And all I had to do was go to an AA meeting, and they were ready to take me out for coffee. And one of those nights, one of those guys I started working with as a sponsor, and we did steps 1, 2, and 3 quickly. It was pretty easy for me to say that I was powerless over alcohol, but I wanted to say that my life wasn't unmanageable because, you know, there were certain things that I hadn't done that I heard people share in a meeting. But when there was things, when I was invited to look at how I was similar, you know, how I had hurt friends and family, how I had lost a job, how the money had gone down the drain, how I wasn't employable, it was pretty easy then when I looked at the similarities as opposed to the differences to know that, yeah, my life was unmanageable. And I'd always had a concept of a higher power, but it was never very continuous. I had a resentment against the word God because it had certain connotations in my mind. And any time where I'd kind of been spiritual in the past, it had been in little snippets, you know, where I'd go on a conference or a retreat and, you know, be real spiritual and then go back to the real world afterwards. I had no concept of the idea that spirituality could be a part of my everyday life and in all my activities. That just had never computed for me before. So I could clearly tell I was insane based on the way I was going and that there must be some higher power out there to do it. And I was ready to give it to that higher power real quick because I couldn't do it. I was exhausted managing it. So we knelt down and said the third step prayer. And I loved doing that. You know, whether it was me going through it for the first time with my sponsor or whether it's me going through guys who have blessed me to have the opportunity to walk through the steps with them. You know, it's a spiritual experience for me every time. Every time. And I got scared about the fourth step. I dragged my heels for a long time, about a month. And my sponsor texted me and said, go find a new sponsor. I can't help you if you don't want to do the work. My very first thought was, it's okay, I can do this on my own. My very next thought was, no, I can't. I have those results. Fortunately, I'd been working with a man to start a young person's group or another AA meeting at a local university in Orlando. And I asked him to sponsor me. And, you know, I told him that I'm at step 4. And he said, that's nice, now you're at step 1. You know, he said, all right, you're going to read the doctor's opinion and the spiritual experience. Oh, I've already read those. That's nice, you're going to read them again. And it was certainly a blow to my ego, but that's what he was testing. That's what he was checking out. He was trying to see if I was really willing. So we did steps 1, 2, and 3, and he assigned my fourth step, and he said, I better get to it because on Saturday we're doing your fifth step. And I found that when I sat down to do my fourth step, it all just kind of flowed out of me. You know, all those issues in my mind about how complicated it would be or this, that, and the other weren't really true. When I just sat down to do it, it just kind of flowed out. And the same thing with my fifth step. All these things I was worried about saying, it just kind of flowed right out. And, you know, my sponsor had pretty much done everything that I had done and a heck of a lot more. And he shared a lot of that, you know, during my fifth step. And per the instructions in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, he had me go and sit down and be quiet for an hour afterwards. And, you know, contemplate on the first 5 steps, had I done them thoroughly. And he said, if I don't hear from you in an hour, I'll know that you'll have gotten on your knee and taken 6 and 7. And that's what I did. And something happened I never thought would happen. The desire to drink left me and has never come back. Now, I'm not going to tell you that the thought doesn't cross my mind occasionally. I'm not going to tell you I don't have a dream where I'm, you know, getting drunk in my dream or something like that. But that's all it is a passing thought. That desire that used to get me off the couch to go to the liquor store, to go to the bar, it's never come back. I've been offered more free drinks in sobriety than I ever did when I was drinking, and it doesn't interest me one bit. You know, so it was time to get to step 8, and I'd already made a list on 4, so it was pretty much a copy and paste job. And then it was time to do 9, and I don't know about you all, but my higher power has a great sense of humor. Because when I got to the 9th step, that weekend I was going to be having a cross-country full family reunion. So there was ample opportunity for me to do 9th step work that weekend. And each of them I thought were going to go terribly, and each of them I was terrified about. And each time they went better than I expected. Each time they actually went well. And, you know, each time I've been closer to that family member now today than I ever was before. You know, one in particular was to one of my cousins who I wasn't even invited to his wedding after starting a fight with another cousin when he was the groom at his own wedding. And then, you know, the following year after I made my amends at that family reunion, I was sitting there holding his firstborn son. Now, if that's not a miracle of the program, I don't know what is, to go from a place where you're not even invited to someone's wedding to a place where you're holding the most precious thing in the world in your arms and nobody's worried about it and they're, you know, happy to have you do it. I asked my sponsor, you know, after I had gotten into my amends, you know, when should we do step 10? He said, how about right now? He taught me how step 10 was about checking in daily, you know, throughout the day, if I'm wrong, to get things right with it, so I don't have to carry a long 4-step on my back and all the problems that come with it. And if I don't catch it by the end of the day, make sure I look into my whole day by the end of the day and get things right the next day as soon as possible. And then I said to him, well, when do we get to 11? He said, how about right now? You know, it's about prayer and meditation. And, you know, he also encouraged me to get a dictionary and look up words, a dictionary that was printed back in the 1930s, because words mean something different today than they did back then. Meditation back then really meant much more about just sitting and being quiet and, you know, just being open to, you know, that higher power, you know, getting access to that knowledge for his will for me and asking for the power to carry it out. Doesn't mean I need to climb to some giant mountain and be silent all day. It means that I need to make that time in the morning to stay close to my higher power and have him guide my activities for the day. And when I asked him, you know, when do we do step 12? He said, well, have you had a spiritual awakening? And I said, well, I don't have a desire to drink, so that'd be a yes. And he said, all right, well, then it's time to start working with others. And I said to him, well, you know, I hear all this stuff about, you know, you need to have a year to sponsor and this, that, and the other. And I had about 2.5 months we'd gotten through the steps. And he asked me to turn to the page where it says you need a year to qualify to be a sponsor. I couldn't do that because it's not in there. He did show me a different page. You know, there's only been one place I've seen a timeline for doing the steps. I see a lot of words like immediately, or next, or upon awakening, things of that nature, but not an actual timeline. And he showed me a story in the back of the big book that was written by a guy named Earl Treat. He got sober back in February of 1937. And his sponsor was Dr. Bob, one of the co-founders of AA. And he talks about how the day before he was due to go back to Chicago, he went to Dr. Bob's office. And they went through the steps in 3 to 4 hours. So he said to me, if they went through the steps in 3 to 4 hours, you're technically like 2 months, 3 weeks, 6 days, and about 20 hours behind schedule. So you need to get out there and be working with others. And so that's what I did. You know, I've had the blessing to work with dozens of guys in the last year and a half. Some of them only get as far as asking me to be their sponsor, and some of them, you know, I've gotten to walk with them through all the steps and watch them sponsor guys. You know, I remember one particular time when I was bumming where one guy that I'd gotten close to and worked with for about 7-8 months went back out, and I called my sponsor. He's this little old Scottish guy with about 28 years of sobriety, and he told me about how he had 100% success rate with sponsorship. So he got my attention real quickly. And he said, yeah, some of them went back to drinking, some of them are dead, some of them are in jail, but I stayed sober 100% of the time. And that made an impact on me, because I was thinking about poor me, my sponsee went back out. Well, it's not about me. You know, it's about that person, and that person's giving me a gift, not the other way around. They're giving me another opportunity to dive into my big book. They're giving me another opportunity to stay sober. They're giving me another opportunity to delve deeper into my spirituality. I've gotten to do tons of things I never thought I would get to do. You know, at 5 months sober, I had a job find me where I had to call on every hotel bar, resort bar, any bar in a 20-county area. And I consulted with my sponsor, and I'd completed my steps, and he said, well, do it, and if it gets in the way of your sobriety, get rid of it. And I kept my higher power close to me, and every time I walked into one of those places, I didn't have an interest in drinking in the least. Not one bit, because I knew where it led me. You know, more often than not, you know, my stomach would do a somersault anytime someone would offer me a free drink or something. It was never just a free drink with me. You know, before I was a year sober, you know, I got to help my sponsor do a tradition seminar at my home group. And it's not because I know anything or am different or special than anyone else in here. You know, when I'm asked to do something, it's not because I know anything. It's because, you know, then it gives me a greater opportunity to learn. It's just another assignment where I get to dig into the big book or the 12 and 12 or other literature or history of AA. And I don't really have to reinvent the wheel. You know, I just need to follow the directions that have been given before me. And, you know, every time when I've been running into an issue, all my problems have been able to be solved. That's one of the problems of the big book. Not just the drink problem, but all my problems. And even when times were really good, and I thought it couldn't get any better, I dug deeper into my sobriety, and things did get better. So, if you take nothing away than just that, no matter where you are in your sobriety, dig a little deeper. I promise you it can get even better. Thanks.
And next up we have Joe.
My name's Joe and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober for 6,000 days, and you know how sober I am? I'm less sober than anybody that got up before 7:45 this morning, because if you haven't drank today, that's, to me, is the hallmark of sobriety. Those 6,000 days are a small portion of the number of years that I drank. I drank for 30 years, most of it heavily. Give you a little history. I'm like him. I'm from upstate New York, not far from Bethlehem, but it's cold, and I've never left there. I've never taken the geographical tour. I did spend 4 years in college, and it was in upstate New York, and I did spend a while in the service, and that was in New Jersey. So I've never traveled. I've never tried to chase away from my alcoholism. My father was an orphan. He came from Staten Island and worked on a farm, had a second-grade education, was Irish. I always say that in our area anyway, it's Alcoholics Anonymous is a disease of Irish Catholics, healed in the basements of Protestant churches. And in our area, there's a lot of truth in that. When he got drunk, he was mean. And I have an older brother and an older sister, but when I was 8 years old, my brother was in the service and my sister was married. So I was basically home alone. My mother worked long hours as a retail clerk, and so my father would get his drinks in and come home, and if he had a bad day, or I was always a wise guy, I'll admit that, I'd get the shit kicked out of me. And that went on for quite a while till I was able to defend myself. And of course, growing up in that era, you would never tell anybody. I mean, I never let even my friends know what was going on at home. And the other side of that was when my father was sober, he was a great guy. But the only reason I bring that up and I tell my story is that I ended up the same way. I had four children. I didn't physically abuse them, but as an alcoholic, I verbally abused them. As you verbally abuse everybody around you when you're an alcoholic, because you're trying to make up for your own shortcomings. Coming from those circumstances and living through that, and then doing the same thing as the mark of a true alcoholic. My mother was one of 13 brothers and sisters, so it was 26 people that were our family, husbands and wives, and I never remember anybody in that family getting drunk or getting out of line, except for my father. So anyway, that was that's my background with alcoholism. I started drinking young when I was 12 years old, at local bazaars where you could steal beers off the table. Went through high school, got in a lot of trouble in high school, but the guidance counselor in high school was a friend of my family's, and so he protected me. I did a lot of things that you shouldn't do. Today they would be considered minor compared to what people do now, but they were things that weren't acceptable in that society. The crowning glory of my high school was my shop teacher, and I ended up taking shop because I had been thrown out of everything else. He had a bottle of whiskey in his bottom drawer, and one day I decided to show off in front of the class and go in his bottom drawer when he wasn't there and take a sip of it. And he walked in the room. Not only did I embarrass him, I embarrassed myself. And the irony of that story is, last year when I was down here in Naples, his son and wife came down and visited with me. So that's how the world turns. And this man spent many years not drinking, lost his job over that incident in high school, and he has six sons, and I'm friends with all of them. And that's an amazing, and I ended up being friends with him too, and we thanked each other for the things, and he's passed away a few years ago. But that's just another of how the world turns in this thing. And Rich was talking about the steps. I hesitated on the steps. I have a tremendous ego. I had jobs where I was the manager. When I was 30 years old, I was making more money than I ever thought was possible. I was the general manager of a Buick dealership and then a Chevrolet dealership. And I found a business. In the meantime, when all this was going on, I went through college like you. I cut corners. I got out of college in 4 years because I did things that you shouldn't do. I didn't get out because I studied hard. I got because I found a test. Somebody told me what was on the test, or you know, you cut corners. But I got out of college, and I was the first one of all my cousins, which I'm one of the youngest of, with that 13 aunts and uncles. I was the first one to graduate from a four-year college. It was a Catholic college in upstate New York, at that time known for its basketball prowess, which was the St. Bonaventures. They had been in the Final Four and et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I went to college weighing 169 pounds. I graduated from college weighing 242 pounds. Food was pretty good, but the beer was very good. And I lined myself up with people that were older and drank heavy, and so I thought that was acceptable practice. And like you were talking about, it reminded me, I might drink with you two guys on Monday, and then you'd go back and study, and then I'd drink with these two ladies over here on Tuesday, and then they'd study the rest of the week, but I'd find companions for each night. And the other people were doing what you're supposed to do in college. They were, you know, trying to get ahead. But I did that, and it was probably a six-day-a-week thing for me, or a seven-day-a-week when you weren't sick. We didn't have things as fraternity. Beer wasn't even allowed on campus, thank God, because if it was, it would have been worse. But anyway, I got out and I went to work for Lieber Brothers, a soap company, for a year. I'm going to go quick through that part of my life, so if you got any questions after, I'll answer them. But I worked for Lieber Brothers, a soap company, and then the war was coming up in Vietnam, and I didn't want to go to Vietnam, but I had an application in for the Army Reserves, and I got in the Army Reserves. And everybody says, this will be good for you. You drink too much. You go in the Army. You get some discipline, et cetera. I'm 23 years old. So I go in the Army, and I go through the basic training because I'm tall and because I'm a college graduate. They make me a platoon guide, so I've got a little power and leadership, and I think, you know, I'm a hot shit, and I'm going on with the ego. And I'm there about 3 days. I'm not drinking because, obviously, you can't get to booze. And the sergeant, who was only a couple years older than me, comes to me and he says, you're older than the rest of these guys. They're all about 18, being prepped to go to Vietnam. And he says, I keep some beer in my room, so if you sneak back and don't tell the rest of the boys, we'll be all right. So I was enabled right through that. And finished up in the service without getting in too much trouble. Got back home, went back to work for Lever Brothers, a soap company. I was doing a good job. They offered to promote me to Cleveland. I didn't want to leave beautiful downtown Binghamton. So I quit the job and I go in the car business. Now, if anybody in this room has been in the car business, they know everybody drank in the car business. The salesmen drank, the owners drank, everybody, the shop people. So it was, you know, I worked in it for 15 years. And during that 15 years, I got married and had four children. I married a very nice girl from a very nice family. I don't know how we ever ended up together, and we're still together after 46 years. But she treated me. There was times when I was good, and there's a lot like my father. There's times when I was the perfect father, and there's times when I was a real asshole. And I think probably as the drinking increased, the assholism come up more than the good parts. But she stayed with me, and probably near the end of my drinking, which my sobriety date, by the way, is June 28th, 1996. Probably near the end of my drinking, she treated me like a fifth child. Anyway, I'm in the car business. I'm drinking too much. I'm smoking four packs of cigarettes a day. I'm chasing everything that's got a skirt. Now I got a wife and four kids at home. And I'm thinking, this is the greatest life of all times, you know, and I'm an asshole. I mean, I can't describe myself any other way. And I start to see my job possibilities fading away. The owner, who was a friend of mine, started saying, you know, this, that. Now, I, in my alcoholism, didn't add up what he was saying. He was saying, you better start performing or you're out of here. And so I finally got the message. And just when that happened, I'm 39 years old, and a friend of mine owns a big funeral home in our area. And he says, you know, there's a job opening selling caskets. And I said, oh, really? And I said, boy, I can get out of this business and I can go into something else. Well, at that point in my life, I got a job selling caskets, and I was in it for 27 years. And it was the greatest job in the world because the only thing that counted was your results at the end of the month. If I was on the road two, three nights a week for 20 of those 27 years, and the only thing the company cared about was the results. If I had a good month, I could do anything I want. I could be anywhere I want. I traveled all over New York State. I knew every town, every bar. Whenever my wife got mad at me, I could say, oh, geez, I got to go to this town, and I'd pack my bag, and I'd get out of there. And by the time I got home 3 days later, she was mad at the four kids, forgot about she was mad at me, so I could do it again, and then to start all over again. And then a Saturday morning had come, and I'd get up and say, geez, I got to go pick up my dry cleaning at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be home at 3 o'clock Sunday morning. You know, where was your dry cleaning in New York City? I mean, that's what I did, you know, and still, she stayed with me. And anyway, that all goes on, the drinking, everything else. Not to bore you with a lot of details, but about 1991, at 5 o'clock in the morning, it's December 7th, I'm throwing up, and I'm sick, and I'm hobbling. And the guy across the street from me, who was a friend of Jimmy and I, had been in AA for 3 years, and had told people he was in it, so I went over and seen him. His name also was Joe, and I said, Joe, I got to get some help. He says, okay, gave me a big book. He said, go back to your house, clean up. I'll see if I can get you an appointment with a counselor. That afternoon, he got me an appointment with a counselor. I go to see the lady. I had drank with her husband. She was a very good counselor. She and her husband were split, and so she knew my name. And, you know, now you feel different at 2 o'clock in the afternoon than you felt at 5 o'clock in the morning. You're cleaned up. You got a tie on you. I'm $1 million, you know. I walk in there, and she listens to my bullshit. And then all of a sudden, she says, you know what you are, Joe? And I says, what? She says, you're a garden variety drunk. That's the first time anybody had the balls to tell me right in my face that I was a garden variety drunk, other than my wife ran and raving. And but, you know, it hit home. I got sober. I started going to meetings. I met a lot of people I hadn't seen in a long time. Small community. So, you know, you drank in all the bars, so all of a sudden you wonder where these people are, and then you walk into AA, and there they are. So, and anyway, so I had a lot of help right off the bat. I My son got hit by a drunken driver 5 months into my sobriety, and he, my height, he ended up being 113 pounds. He had all these things in him, and I became the perfect father. I did everything I was supposed to do. I attended to him in the hospital. I did blah, 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 blah. And my wife said to me, and it had been a long time since I'd heard a compliment from her, she says, you know, Joe, you were the perfect father during this. You did everything an adult was supposed to do. You took care of your son. You took care of your family, blah, 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 blah. And I says, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. A year later, I'm out drinking again. Year later, because I stopped going to meetings. And that's going to be the theme that I'm going to tell you about, stop going to meetings. And I went out and drank. And I drank for about a year. And I got in all the troubles again. Never got a DWI because I knew the cops then, you know, leave your car alongside the road, give you a ride home, et cetera, et cetera. My job was easy. Once I got the sales in places, I was making a lot of money. I got the sales in places. They just reorder on the phone. You know, life was going pretty good, except for the drinking. And then I'm out drinking again, and everything just comes. Oh, the night I went out drinking, and I went out twice. But the first time I went out, my wife was in politics, and she was the head of the legislature. She had all these people in the back of my house at a meeting, and I get a phone call at 6 o'clock at night that one of my best friends died. I get up, walk out the front door. She doesn't even know I'm gone. I get in my car. All of a sudden, her meeting's over 9, 10 o'clock. She's looking around for me, doesn't find me. Gets a call at 3 in the morning. I'm passed out in a parking lot, and drunk as you possibly could be, passed out in a parking lot on the other side of town. She came and got me. The next day, I went out again and drank. The next day, I was supposed to be a pallbearer at my best friend's funeral. I was passed out in the back of a bar 500 yards from the funeral home, passed out. I had been there all night. That's how quick it came back. 30 years of drinking, year and 8 months of being sober, 3 days I'm just as drunk as you possibly could be. Anyway, that goes on. You get through that. More difficulties at home. My wife goes away now. My kids have now are older, graduated from college. My daughter's in Richmond. My wife goes to visit her. I'm running a lot. Jimmy and I used to run a lot together, 16, 17 miles. You know, we thought we were Jim Thorpes or somebody. Anyway, so I'm out running one night with my wife out of town. It's right around Easter. And I go by a bar that I used to hang around with running clothes on. And I go in the bar, and because I'm a drunk. This is why this happened. I had been going to meetings again. After going back, I went to meetings for a year. And now 6 months later, after not being in a meeting, I go by this bar. I go in and I sit to the bartender. Give me a shot and a beer. And he says, you don't drink anymore. I said, if you don't give it to me, the guy down the street will. He gave it to me. I was drunk for 2 months. Traveled around New York State. My company used to pay for my hotels and meals if I was 100 miles from home. I stayed 7 miles from home on 3 different nights. I shit my pants in a town 10 miles from home when I was getting up in the morning, going across the street to get a cup of coffee. That's where I had gotten in 2 months. Alcohol had taken me 30 years, year and 8 months, year and 6 months, now 2 months, drunk every day. During this period of time, my wife finally had enough. She says, you're leaving. You can't stay here anymore. I said, okay. I packed my car and went to Hornell, New York, which was a great drinking town. Drunk night and day for a week. Found a bar that was open at 8 o'clock in the morning, the only one in Chemung County, which is a huge county in New York State. And I found it, and I went there every morning. And then I go back to the hotel room, and I pass out. That was went on for a week. Friday comes. This is what I'm trying to get to in my story. When you talked about when you had that spiritual awakening, this is how it happened to me. I'm coming home from Hornell. I stop in Corning. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I'd already drank for an hour and a half in Hornell. Stop in Corning. I'm in a bar. It's 98 degrees or 90 degrees. The first hot day is June 28th in Corning, New York, home of Corning Glass. And I'm sitting on a park bench after drinking in a bar. For 2 hours, I look down the street and I see my nephew coming up the street. Now, my nephew is 35 years old. He's blind from juvenile diabetes. My sister lived in that town, moved to another town, Elmira, right down the road, but he stayed there. He's 35 years old. He had been a college graduate. He got through college by taking the letter A and putting it on a screen this big. That's where his vision was. That's how he could read the letter A. And he was a champion weightlifter, one of the most popular people in the town. I see him coming down the street with his cane. I said, oh, my God, here comes my nephew. He'll see me. He'll see me, and he'll know I'm drunk because he'll smell me, and he'll hear my voice slurring at 12 noon. I got up, Now, I'm not a crybaby. I got up and I went to my car, which was parked behind the bar. I got in there and I broke down. And I says, here's a kid that had no opportunities, worked his way through life and lived to be 35 years old on his guts. Here I was, everything given to me, great jobs, great wife, great kids. Where am I? I'm in Corning, New York at 12 noon, sitting on a park bench 60 miles from home, drunk. I broke down. I realized that at this point I was spiritually, mentally bankrupt. I had nothing left in my life. And I got home that night, drank on the way home because I'm still an alcoholic. Told my wife that night when I come to the house, she says, you're not living here anymore. I says, give me one more chance. I says, I won't drink again. She says, I've heard that bullshit from you for 30 years. I'm not going to listen to it. She said, give me a chance. And I stayed home. Detoxed that weekend at home with the help of my youngest son. And I haven't had a drink since then. And my life has made a total, total turnaround. I probably have as good a life as anybody could have. I faithfully attend AA meetings. Unlike Rich, I did my fourth step after 4 years in the program. 4 years it took me to be man enough to step up and do my, I admire you for that, step up and do my fourth step, and I did it with a priest at a retreat. And the way it happened, I went to the retreat for confession, I went to the priest for confession, and he listened to me for a couple minutes. He said, you ever done a fourth step? I said, well, no. He says, let's go. So I'm telling a priest all the bad things I did. He said, yeah, I did that. Yeah, I did that. I said, so anyway, I got my fourth step out. The next year I went back to the same retreat, and I finished it up with him. Did the rest of the steps, but putting that off, there was three things in this program. My wife used to say to me, and this was my ego, and this wraps it up. He says, you thought, these are her words, that you were the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. You thought the world centered around you, and she was absolutely right. And what a succinct way to put that. The other thing is, and I wish I had longer, but that's my story. My life since then, since I've retired, I've traveled all over the world. I come down here. I mean, everything is so good to me. I do what I want to do. My wife's not down here with me, but yet she's going to fly to North Carolina to visit some friends of ours. I'm going to pick her up on the way home. And just my kids like me. My youngest son, who got in great trouble with alcohol, not the oldest one to get hit by the car, but when they got really got turned yellow with jaundice, spent 2 months in the hospital thinking he was going to die. We were told that he was going to die if the operation wasn't successful. They operated overnight. Now he's married. He's got children. Those children have never seen me drink. They live around the corner from me. I see them all the time. What a blessing that is, knowing that your four children all saw you drunk and your four grandchildren, maybe, if I'm lucky, will never see me drunk. You know, what a nice feeling that is. So talk about the self-centered and the egotism. Those two things wrap that up. The other thing is, when I chased alcohol, my life was one thing. It was a constant circle of drinking, looking for a drink, or being hungover for a drink. Now, you can take that, and you can make that 30 years, and you can make it 30 minutes, and you can make it 30 seconds. That revolution of those three items was what drove me through my alcoholism. No matter what else I did, whatever else I achieved job-wise or community-wise or anything else, the underlying thing was drinking, looking for a drink, being hungover for a drink, 24 hours a day. Because of this program, I don't do that anymore. And the last thing, and the most important thing I've ever heard since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard this about the second year I was in the program, a man said to me, if you drink again, your past will be your future. Your past will be your future. And I can't do that. But I'm dead if I do it. But you young people, you want to go through that 5 years or 5 minutes or 5 years or 10 years or whatever, where alcohol or drugs took over your system and your life, then do it again. Go out and do it again if you think you can live through it. I know I can't. And that's scary enough to keep me in alcoholism, to keep me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's scary enough to know when I go to Naples, I've got to go to a meeting. Fortunately, I've got a couple friends down here that knew where the meetings were. And if I go to Hornell now, I go to a meeting. If I go to Syracuse, I go to a meeting. If I was in Ireland, I went to a meeting. I have a lot of fun in AA. AA is the nicest bunch of people I've ever met in my life. And the people I've met down here are nice people also. I know there's some bonds created in sobriety because we all help each other struggle and we all help each other to have a better life. And I thank you very much for your attention.